So for the past 25 years or so, my pal Michael J. Lewis, not Moneyball Michael Lewis, has left me regular messages about his beloved New York Jets, usually at some point in the middle of a football game. This week's was particularly special.
They are a fucking disgrace of a football team. Absolute disgrace. They're driving at the end of the first half, no timeouts left. They throw it to the sideline. Guy doesn't get out of bounds. Zach Wilson gets up the line inside the 10 with 3 seconds left. Doesn't get the ball snapped in time to spike the ball and then lose 3 points. 3 automatic points and they're down by 5. They are pathetic. Zach is pathetic. I'm sick and tired of watching him. They're terribly coached. They take terrible penalties. This is awful. They are an awful football team. Thank you. Goodbye.
Now, the Jets wound up winning, and Lou gave me the go-ahead to share his rant. But I do think, at times, it's easy for sports writers like myself to become jaded and numb and indifferent to the stuff we cover. I mean, we've seen these games play out over and over on an endless loop to the point where it can become sort of boring. So sometimes a good old Michael J. Lewis rant, not from the Moneyball Michael Lewis, reminds me why I chose this profession. For the passion. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang. Podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Rick Bucher, the longtime NBA writer and analyst and the current FS1 Hoops big gun. This is episode number 332. Let's sling some yang.
Hey, Dad, your podcast sucks and nobody cares about you now that your show's over.
All right, Rick, first of all, thank you for doing this. Very much appreciated. I'm going to start with something totally weird.
Okay.
So I always like trying to find the oldest thing I can find that someone wrote. You're going to dig this, 100%. Selena's son, October 31st, 1984. It says human body parts list. And it says, you're worth at least $1 million, according to Rick Bucher, writing for the Old Farmer's Almanac.
Yes!
No longer can anyone rightly say you aren't worth a cent, for even the most worn out being carries an inherent worth of more than $1 million. Why were you writing for the Old Farmer's Almanac in 1984?
Well, first of all, as you probably know, like getting into the writing business, I would write for anybody. I mean, I wrote for fishing magazines. If anybody offered something where they were going to pay me to put words to paper, print, whatever, I was game. And so, but in that case, what happened was I was graduating from school or I was looking for a job the spring of my senior year.
So I just want to say, Rick, the funny thing that I love is like, you went to Dartmouth. Usually you go to Dartmouth, you know, like I have friends and relatives who went to Dartmouth and finance and this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Field, and like, you're writing for the Farmer's Almanac, which I just.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the thing, because I started in that direction. I actually accepted a job with Leo Burnett, an advertising agency in Chicago. And about a week after I accepted it, I had had an internship with Sports Illustrated as my junior summer. And the whatever it was, the employment resources department at Dartmouth, a week after I accepted the Leo Burnett thing, they said, hey, there's this little magazine in Dublin, New Hampshire, that has a 1-year residency. And since you had the internship with Sports Illustrated, we wonder whether you were interested. And I was like, yeah, I am. I'm interested. So I said, well, you can drive down and interview or whatever. And they were looking for an editorial assistant for a year. And I applied and I got it. Yankee Publishing published the Old Farmer's Almanac and a monthly magazine called Yankee Magazine. That did stories for, and everybody, like every time I tell everybody that I worked for Yankee Magazine, they're like, oh, really? The New York Yankees? I'm like, no. One of my most favorite stories I did for Yankee Magazine was the stories all had to be based in New England, in one of the New England states, Connecticut being southernmost. The inventor of the wiffle ball was from, I want to say, Bridgeport, Connecticut. I went down and played wiffle ball against the inventor of the wiffle ball and went down and saw the factory, which was just like this like warehouse with this one little machine, like spitting out wiffle balls. That was it. It was the most non-impressive kind of setup you could ever imagine for something that loomed as large in my life as wiffle ball, right? And this guy It was hilarious. He was typical Connecticut guy with like the button down blue shirt and the khakis and the boat shoes and very kind of placid. And then we got on the field and he started talking the maddest trash to me, like immediately. Oh, you cannot hit me. Da, 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 like this whole thing. And so the story was based around playing this guy in wiffle ball and the history of wiffle ball. But
wait, Rick, I want to interrupt you and say something.
Yeah.
The Gift of the Wiffle, October 1985.
There you go.
Born in a Fairfield, Connecticut backyard in 1953, the wiffle ball is probably the most unaerodynamic projectile ever conceived. It will dip, rise, twist, wiggle, and do a fair rendition of Chuck Berry's Duck Strut, depending on how you grip it. I got to say, really good writing for like 21 or 22 year old you. That's strong stuff.
Yeah, I've fallen off since then. So that was, I shot early. Yeah, no, but that was, and shout out to Mel Allen, was an editor at Yankee Magazine who took me under his wing because I was there as an editorial assistant and I wanted to write. And they gave me the opportunity to go out, like I could pitch stories and they gave me a chance to go out and do them. I'll be forever grateful because that really gave me a shot.
Now, I just want to say, like, you would think like, all right, here's Rick. He's had this long career. That wiffle ball story or writing for the Old Farmer's Almanac has to be the weirdest story he's ever done. And yet, November 22nd, 1984, Copley News Service headline, Zoo gets Chinese monkeys, and maybe a surprise bonus. Lead San Diego Dateline, is Rong Rong pregnant? San Diego Zoo officials have been in simian heaven since the arrival of two rare Chinese golden monkeys, Min Min and Rong Rong, from their starter zoo in the People's Republic of China. But imagine how excited they were to discover that Rong Rong, the 14-year-old pound female,
yep,
may be pregnant.
Yep. You know, again, another piece of the puzzle for me was in going to the San Diego Union, and I worked for just about every department there. So I got to do hard news. I got to do features. I got, you know, lifestyle features. Obviously did sports.
Monkeys.
I did one. The Padres went to the World Series for the first time, and there was a guy who was a genius in being able to sell what we now know as swag, basically souvenirs. Mm-hmm. This dude was pulling down like $30,000, had all these little tricks and gimmicks in order to get people's attention and get parents to buy their kids this stuff and whatever. And my great regret, I don't even know why I'm telling this, because this is like, this hurts me to the core. I spelled his name wrong.
Oh.
Spelled his name wrong through the entire freaking his last name. I spelled his name wrong. It was like Olo and it was O-L-O-H. And I think I spelled it O-L-O. And yeah, I've never forgotten that. And it's like one of those things where, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, smartphone era. I'm so glad that those weren't around when I was in college, because God knows if I would have survived, would have appeared in some video that would have crushed my career before it ever started. Getting the opportunity to work on a newspaper and make mistakes early and not have to pay a big price for them. That was one. That one has always stuck with me, where I do not think I've ever misspelled a name since then as a result.
You did get the monkeys' names right, though, both of them.
Nailed the monkey thing.
You and I have very similar backgrounds, actually, which is bounced around to different places.
By the way, before we get to that, it's a real honor to be on the podcast. I've always admired your work from afar, not only just your work, but how you've built your career. Because you really forged your own, and for people who don't understand, like for me, it feels as if you took you bet on yourself a lot and made it pay off. And that's out there walking a tightrope in a lot of cases. And so
don't you feel,
I admire what you've done. And there's a couple of things, the whole winning season thing included, where I'm like, yeah, that's a winning time. That was such a good idea. Why? I'm a basketball guy. Why didn't I think of doing that?
Okay. Then I'm going to ask this. And first of all, that's very kind of you. And I feel the same way. I really do. It's actually weird that I hate to ask this. Have we even met before in person?
I don't think we have.
Which is weird because we've probably been at the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not a friendly guy. Like when it comes to like working and writing.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those guys that likes that. And I'm just, it's not, I don't mean this as critical of anybody who does. And it probably starts just from the competitive aspect of starting out covering the league. Like I'm in competition. Yeah. It's hard for me to be friendly. And I'm going to sound like fucking Tom Brady now. I don't know. I've always struggled with that. So I've always kind of kept to myself. I've always been like, I'm trying to find the story that nobody else is going to tell.
Yeah.
Hanging out with other writers probably is going to run counter to my ability to do that.
Well, it's interesting because I'm from New York and I worked briefly at the Nashville Tennessean, but then I worked at Sports Illustrated and I was covering baseball. And I was based out of New York and I would do a lot of Mets Yankees. And one thing that really informed my sort of worldview of how to approach journalism is you would go watch the New York baseball writers. It was like watching a bunch of guys tussle for a rebound. Like they were elbowing guys under the boards. They were not buddy buddies. They were fighting for scoops. They weren't sharing information. Yeah. And I guess I kind of wonder, because you are of that ilk.
Yeah.
Does the buddy buddy nature of modern journalism, in the way it would maybe bother Larry Bird talking about modern athletes or Magic Johnson talking about modern athletes, does it bother you or does it rub you the wrong way, the way people these days sort of share information and writers go out to dinner and they do hang out and it was much more collaborative than it did when you and I came along?
I've tried not to become the grumpy old dude. So yeah. I don't begrudge that things have changed as far as how people do their job. I think it's just the nature of the business has changed. So like, would I do it that way today? No, I wouldn't. I don't know that I would change anything that I do or the way that I do it. There are a lot of things that trouble me about our business and about writing and about sports writing now, but that probably is not at the top of the list just because I look at it and go, it would be better for me. Like if you guys are all going to be ganging, I mean, that was always my thing. Like wherever the crowd was, I was going to go talk to the guy that I could have a one-on-one conversation with and then maybe circle back if there was somebody that I needed. But I just kind of look at the whole game has changed and I've just tried to adapt, continue to do what I like to do as opposed to trying to hold on to something that is being transformed in the midst of me trying to hold on to it.
I did want to ask you about this. Like we live in a NBA universe now. Obviously it's, you know, the Shams Woj sort of who can break the first thing on Twitter and I'm going to get that person. Then 2 seconds later, well, Woj won that one because he got it two seconds earlier.
Yeah.
I feel like a guy like you, that must make your fucking head want to explode. Or no.
What troubles me is where it's taken us. First of all, like I kind of became known as a newsbreaker to a certain extent because of who I worked for and kind of the role that evolved. But it really came out of the relationships that I built. And as a result, I was finding out things early on and I had a big platform to share them. And so I kind of got that label, at least partly, but it was never an ambition of mine. And I come from the school where I never wanted to be part of the story. I never wanted my breaking the story to affect the business. And we see that all the time now. Now that's almost standard, right? There's deals that get blown up or teams are trying to, you know, float trades out there to see a reaction or a bit. And I think what troubles me is that some of us have now become part of that operation. Mm-hmm. That we've lost our autonomy. It doesn't impact me because of where I am in my career, but now it's like Woj and Shams have kind of cornered the market because of the platforms that they have. And you can come up, and I've just heard this from so many beat guys or enough beat guys that like they can build relationships with the team that they cover and with the coaches and agents and GMs and all of that. And they can be on the cusp of something. In fact, they can get something first and they can't get it confirmed because that GM or that coach or that player or that agent is like, nah, I got to give it to Shams or I got to give it to Woj. And that, like that whole, you're giving it to like somebody's being given it. And I don't want to disparage those two guys because to do what they've done, to tremendous amount of work. I know what it takes to build those relationships. It just, that's, if there's anything about today's sports writing or sports coverage that kind of twists my gut, it's that. It's that the competition field feels like it has been tilted in a way that is unfair to someone who is just coming in and is willing to do the work and is willing to build those relationships. And because they work for a smaller outlet, they're not going to get the opportunity or they're going to have people working against them for them to break that story. And that wasn't the case when I came in. You like, if you were willing to put in the time and the work and you were honest and fair, that got you where you needed to, like you will be successful. And I think you can be all those things today and you're still behind the eight ball.
It sucks. And you cannot help me and you sounding a little grandpa-ish.
But I also feel like it needs to be acknowledged. Like, let's not pretend that this hasn't changed, because it has. And it's just like, it's funny. We were supposed to do this. You and I were supposed to have this conversation a little earlier. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to hunt down Holger Geschwindner, Dirk's longtime mentor, who's back over in Germany. And I finally got him on the phone this morning. And we were talking about like how the NBA game has changed. And he's facing the same thing. He doesn't want to sound like, God, what have they done to the game? Like, we need to get back to it being more of a creative, jazz-oriented type game rather than kind of chess and the analytics of we're just putting building blocks in place and the game's lost kind of its flair and it's so predictable. Everybody plays the same way and it's a very simplified version. Anyway, I was having the same conversation with him about the game, and it's like, I don't know, Jeff, I think sometimes if you're doing something and you do it long enough, you're going to get a point where you see it change. And there's things that I can appreciate that have changed for the better. And there are things where you just go, God, we've lost something there and I don't know how to get it back.
The problem is nobody wants to hear us complain about the good old days, unless they're of our age.
Also very true. Also very true. And I can do as many mea culpas as everyone, or as many like, hey, I'm not being critical of you. Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad now. It's just, yeah, we get it. We get it, Rick. Like it's that. Not the way it was.
It has been 20 years, because we're in 2023. In 2003, you were writing for ESPN, the magazine, which... Mm-hmm. At the time was the big rival of SI, you know, SI, yep. ESPN, the magazine. People couldn't even imagine this now, but it was like a thing where,
yeah,
you know, ESPN, the magazine was every other week and it was really good. And you had a lot of SI editors and some SI writers when there was this bidding war for Rick Riley that was in the millions and this whole crazy thing. And
yeah,
and you were at ESPN, the magazine, and you did a piece, a very lengthy piece about the dynamic of Kobe, Shaq and Phil.
Yes.
And it came out in 2003. And it was divided into parts, part one about Kobe, part two about Shaq, part three about Phil. And you actually, after it happened, you wrote a piece for ESPN, the magazine, and you wrote, I never expected my story about the Kobe Shaq, and then you wrote, or Shaq Kobe to keep everything even, relationship to create such a furor. After all, as former Laker Eddie Jones has since noted, it's not as if the problem hadn't been noticeable before. That elephant has been sitting in the middle of the Lakers locker room, waving its big trunk and passing mighty pachyderm gas for a couple of years now. All I did was describe what it looked like, acted like, and smelled like. It was some groundbreaking shit. And it actually got Shaq and Kobe. It kind of led to a sort of breaking point for them. What do you remember about that experience and sort of what went into it and how it wound up exploding?
Well, I mean, a lot of it was born out of the fact that I saw Kobe when he played at Long Beach State in his first summer league game. And he was like this high school, I mean, literally a high school kid walking out of the locker room. And this is when like things were so relaxed. You could walk wherever you wanted to. and it was in the locker room. I walked in and he's stuffing one of those old style jocks, like the old strappy jock, right? And a pair of shoes into a backpack. And I was like, this is so high school. And this dude has just joined the Lakers. I got to know him really well, probably as well as anybody in the media with him coming up. And it was just a matter of, because I saw him on a veteran team where he was just getting the, like, he was this rambunctious, obviously uber confident young dude who was not going to be buffaloed by older players. And they all looked at him as this young punk who was like, dude, sit down and shut up. And he was not going to do that. And you know what it is? It's exactly what you and I are doing here. Like, we're looking at the young punks who are doing the business now, and we're going, come on, could you guys do it the right way? Like, and that's what they were saying to Kobe. But I was at a point in my life where I was relatively new in the business. And I was like, he just wants to be great. Like, he's just trying to be great. And yeah, there's a little bit of a generation gap. And so when he shot the 4 air balls against Utah, and everybody was crushing him, like, media was just taking shots. Everybody, let's Kobe this, Kobe that. And I was like, the balls that it takes to take a shot with the game on the line and airball it, and then take another one. Yeah. And then take another one. I had this crazy admiration for, dude, you're like 18, 19 years old. You're playing for the Lakers, and you are like, no, I'm whatever. So I just went up to him afterward and I said, look, I know you're getting crushed, but I said, dude, I believe in you. Like, that was impressive to me. And he kind of looked at me with this smirk and he goes, I'd fucking do it again. And I thought, like, wow. But I think because I was alone in going up and saying, you know what? Not everybody's against you. Because I also thought, like, he was like 19, 20 years old, and the entire world is saying, you suck. It started there. And then because I had, like, this is what's, and I've seen this happen with other guys, and you've probably experienced it too, is like, when people see somebody who is at the top of the food chain or is an unbelievable great player, and they see that you have unique access to them, you can, you know, have conversations with them, that suddenly has a lot of other people wanting to open up to you. Like, because somehow, some way, like, whether they think that you can be a conduit to that guy or whatever it is. And so I think just being around and people seeing how Kobe treated me resulted in a lot of people in the Lakers sphere looking at me different, to the point where, like, I wanted to talk to Jerry Buss. I got a private sit down with Jerry Buss. Phil, like, it was suddenly like, oh, he's close with Kobe. Like, you do gain a certain amount of respect or access as a result of that. And I think that was the genesis of how I was able to get inside that. And this, more than anything, was I was tipped off to where I needed to be when I needed to be there to see some of the interactions that kind of defined the way that team was operating. And one of them that I'll never forget was somebody tipped me off about watch when they come out for a game. And Shaq always wants to be the last guy coming out. And Kobe, and I think I put this in the story, Kobe would be standing there and he was wrestling. He wanted to be the last guy coming out, because that's like the, you know, obviously the big cheer for the last one coming out. And so I stood in a place where I could see through the curtains and I could see that whole thing where Kobe's like fussing around. And I think he starts like messing with his warm-up suit or whatever. And I see Shaq look over at him. and just shake his head and then fucking trudge out there because he's realizes this kid's not leaving before I leave. And like after that story came out, suddenly like they made sure those curtains were closed. And, you know, it was one more time where they like closed the gates and blocked things off because something was seen that they didn't want seen. And that's kind of how it worked. It was this organic thing that allowed me to just witness a lot of what was going on. And then as a result of that, be able to ask the right questions once I was sitting down with somebody.
A lot of the writers from that time period, in fact, all of the local writers in that time period told me over and over again, you basically had to be a Shaq guy or a Kobe guy.
Yes. Both. Yes.
You were a national writer coming in. Did you too? Were you a Kobe guy? And then could you still get Shaq material from Shaq?
Well, I was viewed as a Kobe guy. Shaq said it, like, you know, and most guys are like, no, that was very true. You were either a Shaq or a Kobe guy. But I will say there was a point where Shaq was writing a book and I was one of the writers that he approached, which I was really surprised by. Like, I think Mike Wise ended up doing the book. But I also, so I had a very similar experience with Shaq that I think he remembered, which is when he first came in the league and I was just starting to cover the NBA, he was being portrayed as a guy who could just, all he did was dunk. He was a big guy who dunked. And it really aggravated him that he was not viewed as being more than that. Right. And I saw that one, I thought he was more than that. But two, I saw that it bothered him that he was only viewed as that. And I introduced myself and I said, you know what? I think you're going to be all right. And whatever. It's kind of a similar kind of conversation as I had with Kobe. And again, it kind of wasn't the way most people were looking at him at that time. And I think that planted a little seed at a time where going forward, he looked a little bit different than I did. Now, when all this Shaq, Kobe, now, as a result of all that, there was a time where I felt like Shaq and I were at odds for sure. You know, after he kind of felt like he got run out of LA, but he came up to me probably about 5 years ago. We ran into each other. I think it was TNT was doing the award ceremony. They were televising the award ceremony, Defensive Player of the Year, MVP and all that stuff. Big to do in Santa Monica. And I was there. I was with Bleacher Report then. And we saw each other. And I was like, okay, I wonder what this is going to be like. And he came up and he introduced me to his sons. And he said, if you ever get a chance for Rick to write about you, take advantage of it because he will be fair.
Wow.
I was speechless. That was not at all. And I was very flattered. He blew me away. We've been good ever since. And that's where I think Shaq sometimes does get a bad rap in that he can be ultra sensitive and he can react in ways. But I think at heart, like when he cools off, he is unlike a lot of guys in today's game. I think this is one of the other things that changed. Like players, athletes seem to have a harder time facing the truth or having someone speak the truth or say, this is what I've heard about you. You want to give me your side to it. That's always been a motto of mine. Like I'm going to give you an opportunity to speak, but if you don't use it, like that's not on me. And I feel like a lot of that has gone, or maybe the guys have become jaundiced because they don't always get a chance to speak. And I don't know if you've run into this, but you can give an accurate portrayal of something that's happened. And it may not be good. It may be negative. But I feel like if I've done an accurate portrayal of it, I've done my job. And you being mad at me or savaging me because you don't like the result of that news, I feel as if there are fewer players that are able to recognize or kind of come to terms with that compared to some of the guys that I've covered in the past, where it's like, you know what, that was tough, but it was fair. Ultimately, I'm the one who effed up, so Okay. I wish that story hadn't come out, but I can't kill you for having told it. I don't get that today. I get the, like, if you tell a story that's not complimentary on someone, they're cutting you off or they're going to do worse. Like, they're going to try to undermine you as a result of it. That's a depressing aspect of today's business.
First of all, Shaq saying to his son, like, you want him to write about you because he's fair, is one of the greatest compliments a journalist can get. It would be horrible if Shaq said, or Kobe or whoever said, you want him to write about you because he'll kiss your ass.
100%.
And I feel like the problem is today is it's an agent-driven and player-driven society, really agent-driven. You no longer go through, used to be, I mean, you know this, you want to do a piece on Rick Fox, right? You go to John Black, the Lakers publicist. John Black would check with Rick. They would set up a time. You'd meet with Rick. Now, mostly in all sports, you go through the agent first. The agent says, well, what will you be writing about? You say, blah, blah, blah. And the agent will be like, well, is it going to be good to my guy?
Yeah.
And that ends it because, well, he can just go on Twitter and say whatever the fuck he wants. Or you can always find some guy who's going to jerk your client off.
Yes. Yes. That to me is where it's become a business that is transactional. And I see that across the board, whether it's breaking news or telling stories or whatever it is. And that's where we've lost our autonomy. And we've kind of been sold out by our own, by, as you said, those who are willing to do the puff piece or to take the direction. Because I had agents who came to me with stories like, hey, would you write, about this or whatever? And I would say, I'll write this. You're not going to dictate to me how I'm going to write this story or what I'm going to write about. There would be a certain amount of negotiation to say, this is what I'm comfortable writing about because I think that this is accurate and I'm not spinning something for you. I'm telling your side of it, but I'm not going to spin it. And I had agents who said, okay, well, never mind. And I had to be willing to let go of those opportunities to tell a story that somebody else was going to tell or break a story or whatever. And it was painful. Like, there was a part of me that's like, am I doing the right thing by my career in not doing this? But I just, again, and I do not want to sound holier than thou because it's a relationship business. I don't know how much you've had it, but you negotiate, like you kind of figure out where's the middle ground where I can maintain my integrity and you're still like, your subject is getting some of what they're looking for. I just feel like that negotiation, I don't know that it exists anymore. Or if it does, it's for other things other than telling the story in the most honest, straightforward way.
It's very funny. I did an interview the other day. I met with, because I'm working on this Tupac book, and I met with Chuck D, the rapper from Public Enemy.
Yeah.
We had lunch and we talked and he was awesome. He was great. He's a great guy. He's lovely. Everything you'd want and just another human being. He's it. And someone asked me later, said, oh, send me the picture of you with Chuck. And I was like, there's no picture of me with Chuck. Like, I didn't say to Chuck D at the end of the interview, hey, can we get a picture together?
Right.
It's so expected nowadays
that
you would do that. And then you'd post it on the gram. And it's like, what the fuck is happening here? Like, what?
Yeah.
Why would I take a picture with Chuck D? He's not asking me for a picture. Like, why would I do that?
Yeah.
It's just insanity.
Yeah. I'm still doing a fair amount of TV and like advertising who you're with and like all of that is I find myself trying to do some of it because I feel like it's the benefit to the show or the network or whatever, but like I don't do it instinctively. And I have two teenagers now and like they do it. It's just so naturally. I've tried to adopt some of that, but this is a little bit like when you go on vacation and people are just like consumed with taking photos of everything, right? I feel like still at the heart, and this is why I appreciate, again, why I appreciate being invited onto the podcast because my pride still sits with my writing. I'm probably more people know me for TV or any of that other stuff, but at the core, I consider myself a writer and I grade myself and my work based on what kind of writer I have been and still hope to be. And I don't know that I can be at my best in gathering information or the material that I need to write when I'm consumed with recording the moment, when I'm thinking about how am I going to advertise that I'm with these people or in this place, or like that takes away from my focus on I'm trying to extract a story from my surroundings and the people that are here, not shortcut it by advertising that I'm working on this story. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's why I feel like there's a certain amount of conflict. It's like when I'm watching, I'm at a game and I was stunned by this my first experience, this like once we got back in the buildings after COVID, and I'm watching a game. And when there's a timeout, that's when I probably really laser into like, I want to see what's going on in the huddles. I want to see what the interaction there is. And I'm watching not only during the game, but certainly in any break, like all of the media are on social media tweeting out stuff. And I'm like, how can you cover the game without watching the, like, and it's not the score and all that stuff. Half of it's not on the court, but like, I feel like there's so much time is spent on trying to get content out there that it's going out sort of half baked, and we're missing some of the bigger pieces as a result.
You got to ESPN in 1998, which is when ESPN, the magazine, started.
Right.
When I got to Sports Illustrated, I got there in 96, tail end of 96. And I felt like it was my dream, right? So I felt like I was joining this like sacred ground of great writers. And I'm looking all over, and there's Lee Montville, and there's Phil Taylor and Steve Rushen. Yep. And then ESPN, the magazine, comes along, and it's like, oh, challenger to SI. And I'm kind of fascinated. Like, you were there at the beginning of ESPN, the magazine. Was the goal to beat the shit out of Sports Illustrated?
It was a little bit like Woj going after ESPN when he was at Yahoo. Like, I don't know that he would ever acknowledge publicly that he had a jihad against ESPN, but he had a jihad against ESPN. Like, that was just what drove him. And so we would not speak of it, but I think there was this idea that we're going to do it new and better and different. Like, the greatest thing was the magazine was based in New York. Like, we were this independent arm of ESPN. And it was a dream as a writer to go there. I personally, just because I grew up with Sports Illustrated and because I interned there, there was a part of me that always felt like Sports Illustrated was the real stamp of approval as a writer. That my dream was to be a writer for Sports Illustrated. When I had that internship, it turned what I thought I was going to become an attorney to justify the Ivy League education. And that internship at Sports Illustrated, I was like, holy cow, this is, you know, Dan Jenkins and Frank DeFord. And like, there are legends here and they live all over the country and they just kind of like parachute into these amazing events. And I watch these events on Sunday and then they tell me a story on third, you know, Tuesday or Wednesday that I had no idea had happened. And imagine being able to do that job, right? But I don't know. I think I was maybe a little bit too much of a dickhead when I was there as an intern, that I rubbed some people the wrong way. And so I couldn't get back into SI.
I just want to say, as a fellow dickhead intern, but I was a dickhead intern at the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, where I was the worst human being on the planet.
Yeah.
I was a dickhead. What made you a dickhead intern?
I was really arrogant. You know what? You'd have to ask Bambi Bachman.
The late.
She was in charge of the interns and I rubbed her the wrong way. How I did that, like, I really wanted to write and I was very aggressive in wanting to write. And so I was always trying to do like scorecard pieces and whatever. And I was doing my other stuff. I know that at that time in my life, I was very ambitious and I was, I don't know. Maybe I didn't play as nice as I should have. And I probably like was thinking, you fuckers should hire me as soon as you can, like, because I'm going to blow this thing up. Like, I'm ready to go. Like, and, you know, if you got people that have already been there for like 5 years and you got some young fucking whippersnapper, I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Kobe, but I kind of like had probably had the same effect that Kobe had when he joined the Lakers. Like, dude, shut up and sit down. You haven't done anything. Like, relax. That was probably it.
I just want to say, I love this so much because I was the exact same guy, the exact same guy. And it's funny how when you get older, you realize how nobody likes an arrogant 21-year-old. Like, nobody over the age of 30 wants to hear from the arrogant 21-year-old. Nobody cares that you think you're great. Nobody cares that you can write better than so-and-so.
Yep.
Nobody wants to hear it.
Yep. 100%. And you know, would I change anything? I don't know that I would change anything. In fact, I look at my kids. My kids are some of the nicest people. My son is so thoughtful. I just spent a week with him down in San Antonio. He had labrum surgery. Basically, he and I were holed up in a hotel room for like 4 days while I basically just got him food and whatnot. And by Sunday, he was like, "Dad, I think I'm ready to go back to the dorm. I'm going to go to classes tomorrow." And I was like, "Fuck, I'm here till Tuesday." Like, I didn't say anything. I was like, "Yeah, of course." Took him back. And then Monday night, we had dinner before I left. And I said, "Hey, were you like sick of me? Like, is that why you wanted to get back to the dorm?" He's like, "Nah, I needed to get out of that hotel room. And, you know, I felt like I needed to get some stuff done because I was going to go to class on Monday and I wasn't going to do it in the hotel room." And he felt so bad that I might have felt that he was like done with me while I was down there. Called me the next 2 days and he calls me just to say, "Hey," like he's got nothing to say. He's just checking in on me to see how I'm doing. That level of thoughtfulness, that was fucking did not exist for me. Like, "Yeah, Dad, of course I'm fucking sick of you. I got fucking college chicks to see. I got a game to play. Like, I got shit to do." Like, and I sometimes think, you know what? I don't know how successful you guys are going to be because you're not big enough dickheads.
You know what is actually weird? I was a dickhead. You were a dickhead.
Yeah.
Look back at our dickheadedness and thank God we were real dickheads.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we've had long careers in this business. So do you need a tiny bit of dickheadedness?
Yeah.
Just not to that degree. Like, is there something to be said for having a little bit of asshole in you?
I do think, you know, it's the squeaky wheel and the, like, you rather, you know, have to pull back a horse than fucking have to, you know, drag it along. So I think there is a certain requisite level of aggressiveness that is necessary to kind of wade through some of the stuff that, especially in this business, that you're going to have to wade through. And it's interesting because I see, like, when I graduated, my hope was that I could go right back to Sports Illustrated. And that didn't happen. I ended up going to San Diego and working for the newspaper, I did the Yankee magazine thing, and then I worked for a newspaper, and I basically had to build my way back up. And I look back and I am now so grateful that that happened, because I know of people who were hired by ESPN and by Sports Illustrated, like right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And as a result, at least part of their career was built on the name that they were working for and not their own requisite ability to ferret out stories. And, you know, the doors open just a little quicker, a little easier, a little more often when you're working for ESPN or Sports Illustrated. And so I feel as if it was actually a benefit that things turned out the way that they did, because as a result, I had to take my dickheadedness and apply it in my own way and make it work. And I learned all sorts of tools, and it gave me a greater confidence that you can drop me just about anywhere and I will find the story and I will tell that story, as opposed to, well, shit, if I'm not working for somebody who's going to like give me all the access that I need, how am I going to get this done? And I've seen people who have kind of fallen out of the business because they didn't have those requisite tools. They didn't have that toolkit that they could take with them wherever they went.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. And what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt piercing pavilion was closed.
Back in the day, you covered the San Francisco 49ers for the Daily Mercury News. This is during the Joe Montana, Steve Young, Bill Walsh, George Seifert, John Taylor, Jerry Rice. And I'm kind of fascinated by Jerry Rice himself, because he's obviously one of the greatest, if not the greatest NFL player of all time.
Yep.
He's also a very famed prima donna.
Yes.
What was it like to cover Rice?
Oh, man, was he. He was the quintessential prima donna wide receiver. He was first football player I saw that would wear a diamond, would wear an earring, which is just like, you know, it, now it's like passe, but at that time it's kind of revolutionary. And in that locker room, Roger Craig was kind of salt of the earth. Joe Montana, like you had plenty, Matt Milley, you had plenty of stars in that locker room. And they all looked at Rice like, we really appreciate his talent, especially like he was on the other side from John Taylor, who was as quiet and unassuming as Jerry was. I am all of that. Like just watching Jerry put his uniform on, it was a spectacular, like everything was had to be. I'm like, you're about to go out on a field and you're going to get tackled like about 20 times and drug it through the dirt. But he had to look perfect walking out of that tunnel. Yeah, it's so funny, like how when you're inside a team like that, especially a great team like that, and you have a great player like that, and you see how all his teammates kind of look over and he's almost like, you know what? We just got to put up with him because he's really good and he helps us win. But good God, is he just he's a handful. And it's so different from what the public perception of that particular player might be.
Was he likable from a media standpoint?
He wasn't unlikable. You just kind of knew what he was. Like it was about him. And I will say this, ultra sensitive. If you asked a question that might come off as just the least bit questioning or critical, oh man, you could see the hair stand up on the back of his neck. You said what about me? It was one of those. And then meanwhile, you got like all these other dudes around the locker room who like, it's just, you couldn't phase them. They weren't affected by any of that. He was the peacock in the room without question.
You wound up covering the opposite of the world champion San Francisco 49ers. You covered the 1997-98 Washington Wizards for the Washington.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That was the Bernie Bickerstaff coach, 42-40 with Chris Webber and Juwan Howard on the same team. You also had Tracy Murray, God Sham God, Rod Strickland, very young Ben Wallace, Tim Legler.
What a year that was. That was the year where I think Weber got pulled over for smoking weed in his car on the way to practice. There was some party that they were at that, I don't know if it was Juwan. I think it was Juwan got in trouble with, there was some issue with a woman. Rod Strickland went to Tracy Murray's hotel room and Tracy opened the door and Rod cold cocked him and gave him a black eye that he was then wearing in that night's game. There was so much that happened that season off the field. I mean, off the court, that was something else. I want to say that was the year that we still sat courtside at the scorer's table. There was a play where guy drove to the basket and Weber fouled him, but they gave the foul to Calbert Chaney. And Calbert was like, I didn't touch, like, what's going on? And the referee said, and I was there, so I could see this whole thing. Referee said, he's got five fouls. It was the deliberate, we're not fouling out a star from the game. And there was kind of this, like, usually if it was like two guys fouled the guy at the same time or was close enough, they would recognize we're not fouling out the more valuable player. We'll give that foul to the other guy. But I got Calbert to confirm that conversation after the game, and I wrote about it. And that had some ripple effect when it came to the referee in question was not refereeing after that. He actually moved up the ranks. He was one of the directors, the front office directors, but they took him off the court. There was a lot of stuff that happened and a lot of things that me being in the middle of it, writing about it, I know what prompted Tracy getting punched. And to this day, Tracy, there's one of those things where Tracy's like friendly enough, but he's like, yeah, you made me look like a dick. And I was like, well, you kind of were a dick. You and Rod were hitting the same girl and you left a message on her phone saying, why are you messing with that fag? It's the word he used. And the girl played it for Rod. And Rod went over to Tracy's hotel room and punched him. And I wrote about it. And so, Tracy, if you're listening to this, if you're seeing this, whatever, like, dude, that ain't on me.
When you show up the next day in the locker room after writing something like that.
Yeah.
Are you a little nervous someone's going to punch you?
I was never nervous that somebody was going to punch me, but like I've been in that situation enough times. It happened very early in my career. Second year, I'm covering the Warriors and I'm got kind of know everything that's going on with Chris Webber and Don Nelson, knew that that was not going to work. You know, a week or two into the season, C. Webb says to me, I went over to talk to him about, they were playing him at center. He didn't want to play center. He had to play against Akeem and David Robinson and Shaq and all these guys. He wanted to be the next Charles Barkley. So he wanted to play power forward. They were playing him out of position and he didn't like it. And they didn't tell him they were going to do that with him when they drafted him. And so I went to talk to him about like, how are you adjusting to it? You know, how are you doing it? He was like, man, if something doesn't change, I'm out of here at the end of the year. And I'm like, oh shit. We're 2 weeks into the season. They mortgaged their future with like what, 3 or 4 future first round picks and Penny Hardaway to get this dude. And he's leaving at the end of the year. Something dramatic doesn't change. And he goes, but you can't write about it. I'm like, oh fuck. I got to sit on this the whole fucking year. So I said, this is what I'll do. I'll sit on it unless it becomes apparent that there is a problem between you and Nelly. And then I have to write. And he said, okay. And so meanwhile, like I'm talking to everybody else on the team to kind of find out all the background on what's going on between these two in practices and whatnot. About 2 weeks later, there's a blow up in Charlotte. Webb tries to go behind the back on a fast break and he gets stripped and Charlotte goes the other way, scores, and they end up losing the game. But in that moment, he had the turnover and Nelly benches him. And I can see Webb over there like cursing him out. And I can see that all the other writers can see that happening too. And so I went to him like after that game or the next day or whatever. And I said, look, I got to write. So I end up writing a story about this whole background and about that Weber could leave at the end of the year if he doesn't get some assurance from the owner at the time, Chris Cohan, that he will step in if there are issues with Nelly. So we're in Chicago and I asked Nelly one more time. I need to ask you, like, you're saying that there are no issues between you and Webb. Are you still standing by that? And he goes, yeah. Like, why are you even asking me? I was like, okay. So I wrote what I had. And we were in Chicago and all the other writers wanted to spend the night in Chicago and then fly because we were going to Cleveland next. Wanted to go to Cleveland. I was always nervous about flights and being there on time and all that stuff. So we had like a Saturday off. They were playing Cleveland on Sunday. I flew out Saturday morning. Snowstorm hits. All the other writers can't get out of Chicago. My story breaks. It's all over the place. I am the only writer there to meet with Nelly for the pregame from the Bay Area beat writers. And yeah, did I feel some kind of way walking up and like, hey, Nelly? So then I walk out to the court and I think it was Judd Bushler. Judd Bushler goes, I don't want to stand too close to you. There might be snipers out here. And then at one point, Nelly walks over and asks me to sit down on the bench. And he goes, I think you're a piece of shit. I think your newspaper is a piece of shit. Don't ever call me. Don't ever ask me for anything. I was like, okay. I didn't know what else to say. Because at the very beginning of the year, I know I'm going on with this, but when I first took the beat, I went in and met with Nelly and said, look, I understand that you might not be able to answer every question that I have. And there are certain things that you can't tell me. I'll take a no comment, but don't purposely steer me the wrong way. And I probably spent way too much time elaborating on how I was trying to approach the job or whatever. But when I was done, he looked at me and he said, well, if I got to lie to you, I'm going to lie to you. And I was like, okay, kind of liberating. Like, I will always give you a chance to respond, but I don't have to take, like, if you tell me this isn't happening and I got other people who are telling me that it is. You don't carry the same water now. And so that's what led to that whole thing. And then the web thing ended up, you know, I mean, I had everything. I knew I was 1,000% right on everything that I had presented. And I tried to present it like, I didn't present it like it was Nelly's fault. Like, I just said, these are two guys that do not see eye to eye. That is the longest winded answer to your question about, have I ever written anything and walked into the locker room the next day and felt nervous or thought I was going to get punched?
It's a final question on this podcast. It's a question I'm required to ask everyone. You might have just answered it, but maybe not. What's the best confrontation you've ever had with an athlete or coach?
Don Nelson and Kevin Garnett are the two people that I feel like I had a conflict with that was never fully resolved. I never felt like we got past it. Mm. And with KG, I did a piece on him and Wally Szczerbiak in Minnesota. The essence of it was Wally versus the rest of the team. The rest of the team had to appreciate that Wally gave them something in his shooting that they weren't going to get anyplace else. And Wally had to appreciate that he would never be sniffing all-star status if it weren't for the fact that he played with KG and this Minnesota team that allowed him to be a star. But the cover was Warring Wolves. And I think it had like KG and Wally as the two wolves. And KG was like, I said, dude, you didn't read the piece. I know what the cover was. And I don't know that he ever did. Somebody read it and told him. And anyway, like, we had always had a good relationship. On a previous cover story I did on him, I convinced him to have his entire body painted blue for the cover, like Timberwolves blue. And we had, you know, we'd had a good relationship up until then, or a fair one, amiable one. But after that Warring Wolves, I could never get him to like sit down and talk about it.
And he probably still has blue paint, like, you know.
Probably some, a little bit, like, right, you know, some crevice.
Well, Rick, man, number one, I appreciate you doing this. Number two, big admirer of your work, big admirer of your approach. And I support you in your battles with Don Nelson.
Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, Rick Bucher, for joining me on Two Riders Sing and Yang. And follow Rick on Twitter at Rick Bucher. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.